We see ourselves in a spiritual sense as passing through a dark night. The dark night is not easy and we cannot predict its stages, but a dark night is a process, and this gives us the hope that we are coming through into a new order and recovering the sense of Christianity as a wisdom tradition, not just as a moralistic or institutional kind of religion.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn. When I first started to practice daily meditation or contemplation and started to feel like I was experiencing the benefits of that practice, well, I wanted to share that with people I love, and I invited one of my adult children to do a 5-minute meditation with me. They said, "No way. That sounds incredibly boring." I said, "Well, I'll lead you through it, so at least you will have my voice to listen to." They said, "Still sounds boring." And so I tried, "How about 1 minute of breathing and meditation?" Well, it's been years. We still have not done that 1 minute together. When you think of meditating or contemplating, does that sound unspeakably monotonous or boring, even frightening, being with your own thoughts? So if you've ever panicked about sitting with your own thoughts for an extended period of time, you might take heart by listening to our guest today, Father Lawrence Freeman. Before entering monastic life, Father Lawrence Freeman worked with the United Nations in New York, in banking, and in journalism. He's director of the World Community for Christian Meditation, WCCM, an inclusive contemplative community. A prolific author, his most recent book is Tasting Wisdom, Meditations for Every Day of the Year. He was awarded the Order of Canada in recognition of his work for interfaith dialogue and the promotion of world peace. I started the conversation by asking him about the Benedictine Order.
The Benedictine Order is the oldest religious order in the Christian world. It was founded, I don't know if it was even founded, I don't think St. Benedict thought that he was founding an order, but he started a network of communities in Italy about 1500 years ago, and he wrote a rule for life, how people who are seeking God, he said, truly seeking God, can live together without killing each other and persevering until the end. The Rule of St. Benedict, it's a small little document, but it's one of the most influential documents, I think, in Western civilization, really. In the later Middle Ages, in the 12th, 13th century, other religious orders began to develop, like the Franciscans and Dominicans and so on. But the Benedictines are essentially an order or a way of life which is not highly centralized. Each monastery has its own unique identity. I think the essential principles of the Benedictine life and rule would be moderation, regularity, prayer, work, and study would be the essential elements of that life, which correspond, you could say, to body, mind, and spirit. In my own life, I joined the Benedictines in, I think, 1976. And I have lived different forms of that Benedictine life since then. Now I'm a Benedictine monk, and we have a community in France, which is our international center called Bonnevaux, that is developing, I would say, a new form of this ancient tradition.
I appreciate the introduction. You will be contributing to the upcoming Faith and Science Conference being held in Rome. People can check that out at faithandscience.eu. And I wonder if you talk to me about what you will be presenting about contemplative life.
I think my focus would be the fundamental importance of contemplation, contemplative consciousness, as a way forward through our present disastrous pandemonium and crisis. And things do not look as if they're getting better at this moment. And I think one of the underlying reasons is that we have lost our balance. So what I'd like to talk about in the Faith and Science Conference is, how do we overcome this disastrous imbalance that we have led ourselves into? How do we understand what has happened? And that is vital, I think, that we reconnect to our own contemplative nature, as human beings, that we teach contemplative practice to children and generally recover this wisdom dimension of life. And that is so important because otherwise, I think it's very difficult to live with hope. I think many people are losing hope. They're losing connection. They withdraw. They feel helpless or angry. We either see that we're in a downward spiral going into a big crash, or we see ourselves in a spiritual sense as passing through a dark night. And the dark night is not easy, and we cannot predict its stages. But a dark night is a process, an evolutionary process. And this gives us the hope that we are coming through into a new order and a new level of consciousness in humanity as a whole. My point is that faith and science need to collaborate. They need to dance together. They need to respect each other. And I think more and more that is the case. And that will enable, it will enable the world to understand the importance of recovering what we have lost or forgotten. That is this wisdom dimension, the contemplative dimension of life. Without that, I think we are headed for further pandemonium. Mm.
Well, thank you for the explanation. And I wonder if you could talk, for someone who has heard of contemplative life, contemplative prayer, how is that distinct from the other kinds of prayers that every faith tradition and even people of no faith find themselves uttering something often to the universe or, quote, God, if you're there? How is this kind of prayer different?
Perhaps one of the most important questions for our time is, what is prayer? What do we mean by faith? And how is faith different from belief? I think these are distinctions which really will help us to regain our balance and clarity. I think the best way I could answer that briefly would be to say that think of prayer as a big wheel, and it touches the ground. There's a sense of movement or progress, like wheels take us somewhere. The wheels have to touch the ground if it is to be a journey, to move us, to lead to development and to growth. And think of an old-fashioned cartwheel with the different spokes of the wheel. And the different spokes of the wheel represent what we usually call the different forms of prayer. And you have all sorts of prayer, many of which are replicated or identifiable in all traditions. There's worship, there's more intellectual prayer, there is praying together in a large group, praying together in a small group, praying on one's own. You have candles and you have incense and you have all the other things. So prayer is a universal human phenomenon, and many of the external forms have deep resonance with each other, which is also very significant. So in the Christian understanding, you could say we have, depending upon your particular Christian tradition, you have the sacraments, you have the scriptures, you have petition, intercession, worship, different forms of worship, you have praise, you have pilgrimage, and so on. So many different forms of prayer. And we should be very inclusive about prayer. We should never criticize or mock or whatever another person's way of prayer. People pray in different ways at different times according to their circumstances and so on. But all of these spokes of the wheel converge in the hub of the wheel. And what do we find in the hub of the wheel? This is the big question. Now, different people, different traditions will give that a different definition. You could say, for example, that at the hub of the wheel, we find, from a Christian perspective, we find the mind of Christ, the human consciousness of Christ in its risen state. You could also say we find God at the center of the wheel. Each of these is a different way of responding according to circumstances and people's beliefs to what is the essence of prayer. You could even say pure prayer, prayer in itself. And another more universal way of understanding what we find at the center of the wheel is stillness. There's a verse in the Psalms that says, "Be still and know that I am God." And this stillness, the calming of the mind, is the essence of prayer. It is what all prayer is moving us towards. All of these different forms of prayer are really taking us into this wakeful, enlightened stillness. And this is where meditation comes in, or contemplative practice that leads us into the gift or the grace, the natural state, in fact, of contemplation. So meditation, you could say, is the work we do to receive the gift, the grace, the reality within us of contemplation. That's how I would see prayer. I think we need an integrated model, and we shouldn't, I think, separate these different forms of prayer as if they were in competition with each other. The problem for many Western people is that we have lost this familiarity or this understanding of contemplation itself, indeed of wisdom. And therefore, if you are religious as a Western person, you may be very suspicious of contemplation because you're not thinking about God, or you're not speaking to God, or you're not asking God for good weather or to solve the political threat. You may well feel, and some do, depending where they are on the spectrum of spirituality, that meditation as a practice and contemplation as a reality doesn't belong in your Christian perspective. Whereas I think in nearly all the other traditions, contemplation and meditation are regarded universally as central. And even in the Eastern Christian world, the Orthodox Church, they never lost this prayer of the heart, it could also be called. And the Jesus Prayer, of course, is a characteristic of the Orthodox Church. So it's a little varied, of course, interculturally and even between Christian denominations and Christian churches. But I think our work has been, as a community, to try to recover and restore this contemplative dimension to Christian world. It's also recovering, really, the wisdom dimension and recovering the sense of Christianity as a wisdom tradition, not just as a moralistic or institutional kind of religion.
Could you tell me the story of you discovering this? Is it something you had been aware of in a prayer life, or was this something new to you that you had to learn? I'm really wondering what your personal experience with this was.
I was brought up as a Catholic in England, and I'm very grateful for that formation and even for that devotional side of Catholicism. I think it opens a language and an experience and an affectivity in prayer. But I'd never heard about meditation. But I was fortunate to know John Main, Irish Benedictine monk, who has been very instrumental in helping to restore this lost dimension to Christian prayer and Christian life. I went to see him when I was in my first year at university about some other issues. I'd already begun to drift away from childhood sort of religiosity or spirituality, and I was reading a lot, and I must have read about meditation a million times. It didn't click, but when I met him, he introduced me to meditation in a very few words with a very light touch. And I knew at that moment that what I was hearing was immensely life-changing and important and authentic. And what I knew was that I didn't understand it, but at the same time, I trusted it. And it had an actual effect upon me. When I heard about it, I knew in my heart that this was something that I was being awakened to. And I felt a desire, a deep desire to enter into this experience. Now, I was quite young, a first year at university, so it took me a few more years before I got very close to any kind of practice, and that eventually led me to become a monk. But that was my journey. And I think the reason I didn't understand it intellectually was because I was trained by my educational system to see everything intellectually or from the head. And when he said that when we meditate, we leave words, thoughts, and imagination behind, that was fascinating. And at the same time, I thought, I don't understand that, because it would be as if you were unplugging a computer and expecting the computer to work. But I realized through that transmission or through that teaching that he gave me that the way into reality at the deepest level is through paradox. So what might seem like a contradiction turns out actually to be a paradox. That's what I've been finding ever since.
So you said that you didn't understand it at first because you were approaching it intellectually. And I relate to that. I always thought of meditation as some special power of the mind, like mind over matter, mind over body. But as I've practiced, I've discovered it's actually getting myself out of my mind, the endless chatter the Buddhists call the monkey mind, and becoming a relaxed and attentive observer of my thoughts and physical sensations, actually experiencing a wholeness of body and spirit rather than this giant mental power surge, which is a place of presence and of peace.
Your book, Tasting Wisdom, Meditations for Every Day of the Year, there are different kinds of meditation I've read about, some where you are just observing the thoughts as they come and go. But then there are times when someone will meditate on a particular word or a particular scripture. And I'm wondering, with Meditations for Every Day of the Year, what was the intention here, that there would be a place of focus for people who are learning this? Could you tell me about that?
Yes, I think that the word meditation is a rather vague word today. Mm-hmm. And if you look up scientific research, for example, into meditation on the internet, you'll find hundreds or thousands maybe of studies based on mindfulness. We have to really define it and or understand it in its nuances. So I would say that what we're teaching is a very simple, radically simple form of meditation, contemplative practice, which is not in any way opposed to competitive with mindfulness or other forms of meditation. As I said, there are many spokes in the wheel. But I make a distinction, I think important one, between preparation for this deep, simple, radically simple practice, which leads to transformation of one's inner consciousness. And the preparation could be calming, reducing stress, or even a form of enrichment through the use of the mind and reflection. So all of these are good forms or spokes or forms of prayer. But I think we need to see that the essence of prayer, which in my own tradition, the early Christian monks called pure prayer, oratio pura, offers us a way, simple, direct way. Now, simple doesn't mean easy, but it does mean possible. You can do it. Anyone can do it. And in fact, the easiest people to teach meditation to in the way that I'm describing are children. Maybe children and very old people if they're awake. The reason for that, I think, is you can discover it in the Gospels, Jesus is a teacher of contemplation, and he doesn't give a particular method, but he describes the essence of meditation, interiority, go into your inner room, silence, don't go babbling on, talking all the time. Thirdly, he says, do not worry, so find equanimity, calmness of mind. Then he says, be mindful or set your mind on God's kingdom. That doesn't mean think about God. I think it means much more attention, pure attention, objectless attention. And then finally, he says, be in the present moment. Now, those are the ingredients of contemplation. And those are the qualities that we're developing in the practice of meditation as we teach it. As I said, it doesn't replace or reject other forms of spiritual practice. But it does give you, I think, a better model and a better sense of the goal and of the immediacy. It's not complex, but we today are so uptight, so distracted, so superficial, that when we sit down to meditate, we begin to lay aside our thoughts, our words, our imagination. We may panic. We may just feel we're failing. And this is where it's very important that we see it not just as a technique of stress reduction. It does reduce stress very much and brings you peace. But it's not a technique of stress reduction. It is a discipline. And discipline is not a very popular word, maybe, unless you're learning a musical instrument or a language and you really want to learn something. You accept a discipline and embrace the discipline and love the discipline. But the word discipline means learning. So we approach meditation as a learning process. Little by little, step by step, we start where we are. Maybe we can only meditate for 2 minutes to begin with. But with support, friendship, community, you can build up that discipline. And then your life begins to be transformed.
A lot of people will think monasticism might be, let me separate myself from the world, but you have found a particular kind of engagement. You've studied at Oxford, worked at the United Nations. Your efforts on health and meditation, in fact, led to a contemplative healthcare initiative at the Royal College of Physicians of Ireland. And Canada has awarded you one of its highest honors. How do you see, you've hinted at this, I think, already, but how does the work you do with organizations or countries or in the United Nations on this subject tie in with what you feel as your call as a Benedictine monk?
The bottom line is my own practice. I became a monk through meditation, and maybe because I'm not very disciplined, and maybe because I'm a slow learner, I needed to become a monk in order to do that. But I don't think meditation is self-centered. I don't think it's just for the meditator, because the whole essence of meditation is that it takes you beyond your isolated egoism or narcissism or self-centeredness. This is why it's transformative, because it frees us from the fears and the desires of the ego. Now, that means that we see meditation as a gift to be shared. And it's not something to be sold or marketed. It's become commodified and commercialized in many ways today, because that's the way we are as a society. But meditation itself is a gift to be shared, as I found in my own life. So once I was living as a monk and meditating morning, midday, and evening, if I'm traveling or if I'm whatever I'm doing, I keep to that schedule as possible. What grows out of that is a sort of, what's the word, sort of attraction. People are attracted to centers, communities, where this practice is being lived in a simple way, in a lifestyle, as we do in Bonvaux, where I live in France now, our international retreat center. So I don't see any contradiction at all between personal practice and teaching and helping with a wide community, an organization that wants to share this, because we realize how important it is for the world. Now, you have to be careful that you keep your own practice paramount and make that the priority. And this is why our teaching is really quite simple. We say, try to meditate twice a day, morning and evening at least, minimum really. Eventually, you build up to that. But in terms of my monastic life, it's integrated with other forms of spirituality, of scripture and of worship, and also times of solitude, times of silence. So I need, if I'm talking a lot like I am now, then I need to recover.
I appreciate your time, and I know we are getting close here, but in the last little bit, I don't know what exactly your experience of finding God or making a connection was, if that was with meditation and contemplation, or what came before that. But what have you learned over the course of your practice about God? Or how has your relationship to the divine changed or deepened?
Well, I think when I was very young, I had a strong sense of God, but it was a God other than me or outside of myself, and therefore a God who you could appeal to if you wanted something or there was a problem. That's very universal, of course. But I would say that through the practice of meditation and a contemplative vision or contemplative understanding of reality, I would say it has become radically simplified. And I would say there is only God. Where is God not present? Mm. God is all in all. And God is the ground of being. And although our minds, our egos can intrude and complicate and fill us with confusion or with egotistical behavior or whatever, nevertheless, we can always come back to this fundamental truth that God is. God, in the biblical revelation of God, is simply I am. God is I am. If we can build times a dimension of stillness into our lives, and many people would say, oh, I can't, I'm too busy, I'm too distracted, I've got too many demands. I think it's vital that we do. And if we want our action, our activity, our work to be fruitful and meaningful, and useful to others, then we have to remain connected to this inner stillness and this understanding of the universality and the silence of God, I think we just have to realize God is beyond words, images, and thoughts. And yet, where is God not?
Father Lawrence, you mentioned people being too busy or distracted. You reminded me, I heard someone say, if you don't have time to meditate for 10 minutes every day, then try 20.
Yes.
Meaning it's that important. And if you're that busy that you don't have 10 minutes, you need it even more than you know you need it. Finally, do you have a story or an example of helping someone discover or seeing someone discover this and it making a change in their life?
Many stories. People I teach or speak with about meditation teach me a great deal. And I'll give you one very practical example. When we meditate, we take a word, as I said, and we repeat this word silently in our heart, letting go of thoughts. And one of the things we say is, you're not supposed to think about the meaning of the word. We recommend, generally, any different words you could choose and different religious traditions as well. But we normally recommend the word Maranatha. Maranatha is an Aramaic word, the language that Jesus spoke. It has two meanings. One is come Lord, and the other is the Lord has come, which puts the finger on the paradox that I was talking about. But we tell people you don't think about the meaning of the word as you say it. You just repeat it and listen to the word and let go of thoughts as they arise. And I was talking to somebody once who was saying that they still had been meditating for 3 or 4 years. And he said, I'm still finding meditation very difficult. And then I sort of repeated the basic teaching, as I just described. And he said, oh, you mean I don't have to think about the meaning of it? Now, he must have heard that 100 times. So I think every person comes to this awakening or understanding and insight in their own way. All that matters is that we are on the way. We don't have to evaluate ourselves or think we're great meditators or experts or any of that. We just have to be. And then the day will come when something opens up and you see it and you say, oh, why didn't I get that before?
Many thanks to Father Lawrence Freeman for speaking with us. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Aaliyah Ebert, Katarina Martinich, and James Sturdivant. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen, Ashton Parkinson, and DJ Cromarty. If interfaith understanding is important to you, be sure and leave a comment or positive review on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. And find us on Instagram and Facebook at In Good Faith Podcast. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join me again soon, right here, In Good Faith. Hi, I'm Stephen Cap Perry, host of In Good Faith. In our BYU Radio family of podcasts, I've got to tell you about an award-winning podcast called Constant Wonder. Are you ready to immerse yourself in the awe-inspiring world of nature? That's what Constant Wonder does. Host Marcus Smith brings us on trips and conversations with people whose lives have been touched by the beauty of the earth and exploring its mysteries. If you crave some adventure and you want to travel the earth, but it's hard to fit into your schedule, do what I do and listen to Constant Wonder, riveting conversation with individuals whose lives have been impacted and changed by their explorations of the earth's beauty and its mysteries. Constant Wonder, wherever you get your podcasts.